This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week, we're going to put you in the mood for a boiling of new tatties.
Out of Doors with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Thinly veiled behind cloud, just to the left-hand side of the church spire, there is a snow moon. It's a micro-moon, apparently, because it's far away, and therefore slightly smaller to the eye. Who knew these things? Well, apparently our producer, Helen Needham, who's been checking up for the last hour and a half. I'm Mark Stephen, sitting right beside me here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
We've basically been sitting here. We know nothing about that, but it's good to get it introduced into the programme, I would say. It's been a lovely few days. I don't know what it's
gorgeous,
been like.
Gorgeous,
yeah. Absolutely. Actually, gorgeous. A fair bit of heat in the sun.
Yeah. Although, having said that, I think it was Thursday morning. I was standing outside Dynamic Earth in Edinburgh. By Jove, when you're out of the sun and in the wind, you knew all about it.
It's chilly. It's actually a really frosty start here today. But hopefully that means it's going to turn into another scorcheroony. Well, at least maybe 5 or 6 degrees. That's what we're aiming for. Let us know what your plans are this weekend. We like to know if you'll be basking in sunshine or if you'll be staying cosy indoors. It'll be outofdoors at bbc.co.uk as the email address, which you know, 80295 if you want to text us, or 0808 592 9500 if you want to give us a ring. Sky's here this morning taking your calls.
I couldn't work out whether she's got those cordless headphones or whether they were earmuffs.
I think they're earmuffs because I think they're quite trendy.
Are they?
Yeah, I think they're quite trendy.
We're bringing leg warmers back next. This week I've been on board RRS Discovery in Dundee to find out what condition the former Antarctic survey ship is in, and you know, it's a bit of a spoiler. It's going to need some help.
I've been learning about hedgelaying in Ayrshire, but first, the moment of course you've been waiting for. It's time for the Out of Doors mystery sound.
Clearly mechanical this week. Clearly, I would say.
Yeah, it's a kind of rumbling noise that my husband makes when he's trying to get out of the house quietly in the morning. You know, that kind of noise.
After he's finished his trumpet practice.
Yeah. Oh. Get in touch with us then, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or the number to call 0808 592 9500.
Situated in a very pretty valley between Biggar and Peebles is a 56-hectare area of woodland called Broughton Now. Now, it's an interesting place because a local group, the Friends of Broughton Now, are in the process of trying to buy it. John Hart is the founder of the group, and I met him just as he was taking his dog out of the car to walk it.
Hang on, Bruno. Hang on. Whoa! There he goes. Ready for action? It's a new woodland. It was planted in the 1980s by David Balfour Scott, Major, I believe, and he sold it in the year about 2000 to Christopher Lampton, the present owner, and he's guided its developing maturity very carefully. So instead of clear felling the commercial bits of plantation, he's done a sort of continuous cover, irregular forestry regime. There's a lot here. It's really good. During lockdown, I was walking here every day because it was just on my limit of a 5 mile radius, you know. So I was coming with Bruno and my wife Pam. I was recording the wildlife. Look at the snowdrops. Wow.
Isn't that fantastic?
Things have come on in a week.
The woods are carpeted with them.
Yeah. And I got chatting with Christopher, who owns the woodland. And he has always been fairly philanthropic about the development of it, wanting it not just to be a commercial venture. He wanted it to be a community asset. So the local people could come and dog walk, for instance, or other aspects of appreciating a woodland. And he asked me if I could help him get a team together that could then apply to the local wind farms. There's big wind farm developments around here, and they have money, funds, which they give out for good causes. And as a landowner, you can't apply for them.
No.
It needs to be a community thing. So
what kind of things did you do with the money?
Well, what we did was to get a team together. The Friends of Broughton now had all developed. Committee, we had to get a bank account. There's quite a lot to do to get this thing up and running to meet the wind farm criteria. And then we put in an application for £16,500, a lot of money, and we were awarded that in full to meet our the plans that we'd submitted, which was to put in new paths, amenity work, new pond. We've got two ponds, and do some work to increase the biodiversity, nest boxes, planting of native shrubs and wildflowers. So we did a lot.
You say £16,500 is a lot of money. I listen to that and I think that must have taken a lot of volunteer labour, you know, of free community-based time, because otherwise £16,500 isn't going to go far at all.
Yeah. No, a lot of the work was done by volunteers. Yeah. So this path that we're walking on, this was a key part of the spend of getting a contractor in. We put in a lot more paths. We put in an equivalent length of hardcore pathwork with just volunteer work. That was part of the wind farm stipulation, that there was to be a contribution from the community in the work that was being done.
So there was a history of community involvement here.
Yes.
How did that tip into potential ownership?
When we'd spent the money, I thought we could sit back and enjoy it, and because Christopher did as well, his health began to deteriorate. He's got Parkinson's disease. He just hasn't got the strength to do what he was doing. He was hands-on in the woodland, and he approached me one day and said, look, I think I'm going to try and encourage a community buyout. What do you think? So I said, oh, no, heavens forbid.
The wind farm finished for the love of goodness.
Was enough. Yeah. But he said, no, I'm serious. So we began to gear up.
How much money are we talking about?
There's three lots, so it's about £900,000 when you put the three lots together.
So there must be more. Must be more than you involved in this. So you mean, how do you get community buy into this? Because I mean, that's a big tack on.
It's scary. But we had to convince the wind farm that was community involvement. So I started by putting a notice up in the notice board. Friends of Broughton Now, you know, proposed community group. Contact me. Nothing. Underwhelming response.
The tumbleweed was crossing the car park. Yeah.
So, but it inspired two people. So one of them, Kevin Long, he sidled up to me and said, this is, you know, great idea, John. You know, you must keep pushing, keep going, you know, and think big. He said, what I could do is create a Facebook page. And that will, he said, people are much more likely to respond to that than a notice in the car park. The other one was the chappy in Brook, who fills in all the forms.
The money man.
Yeah, we couldn't manage without him. As soon as we started Facebook, it went up to 50 very quickly, then 100, and now it's well over 300. So there are a lot of people, followers on Facebook. What we're going to try and do is form a membership with maybe, an annual charge or something like that, because we've got to start thinking about finances. Cool. It's got to be financially, you know, a viable scheme that we have here. Otherwise, we won't get any funding.
A lovely view. Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you. That's fantastic.
There's a view. We can stop and get our breath back.
Yeah, precisely.
We've just walked up the new path that was put in. I call it the zigzag path because it's zigzags up through the woodland.
Is there a history of community involvement in this area? I mean, do people willingly get involved in quite a few projects?
Yes. Yeah. Broughton has just bought out its local shop. Mm-hmm. And it is run now as a community, run successfully as a community shop. We were worried that there might be overkill, you know, that suddenly deciding to buy woodland, which is, you know, costing more than the shop, people might not be up for it. So we held a community meeting right at the beginning when Christopher put the woodland on the market through Goldcrest in the village hall in Broughton. We publicised it pretty well and we got 70-odd people turned up at that meeting, and there was only one dissenter. Okay. So, you know, it was 99 point something or other in favour of going for it. And we used that as a strong indicator that there was a community desire to buy the woodland, and we pressed on from there. And we had another community meeting just a week or so ago with a development group that we've got now making our management plan for us. We were talking about community, you know, the ways in which the community will be able to use the woodland after purchase if we're successful.
John Hart with the Friends of Broughton Now.
What the power of social media, eh? To go from no interest to quite considerable amounts of interest.
Two people that actually looked at the poster in the car park. I have to say, the old poster in the car park, you know, approach to things, that time's probably gone.
Yeah, probably is. But there's huge demand, isn't there, for these kind of spaces? I'm just thinking that, you know, if you go anywhere in the summertime, any sort of woodland area, popular woodland areas, you see all of these lovely community groups using it, school kids and brownies and scouts, and there's a real appetite for it.
Yeah, no, all of the above. And the thing is, you could theoretically have community interest groups in there, you could have employment, you know, they might need to hire a forester full-time, that kind of thing. So, you know, let's move the seat back a bit. the fire has started to smoke,
and we can't see.
And you're screwing up your face, so and you can't see anything. No, but I mean, nearly £1 million. It is a big tack on.
It is. Oh, it definitely is. Yeah. moving on a little bit, kind of similar theme, hedge laying. Do you have a go at that?
Yes, I have, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
yes.
How did you find it? Was it a bit terrifying to start with?
I was fascinated by all the tools, I must confess. I haven't got one of those, and I haven't got one of those.
Oh, I thought that might appeal to you, yeah. An enthusiastic group of volunteers in Symington in Ayrshire have been getting to grips with hedge laying as part of their efforts to make their local verges pollinator and nature friendly. Now, they looked utterly terrified when they started this. But expert Graham Walker held a session showing them how to do it, trying to give them a bit of confidence, and he's hoping that they can pass their new skills on in the future.
If you cut through it, it's not a disaster, okay? You will lose your pleature. Don't worry. You won't be sent home.
Yes, they will.
I'm Graham Walker from Kelso in Roxburghshire, and I'm one of the few professional hedge layers that we have in Scotland currently working. Hedge laying is the traditional way that all hedges were managed in the past. They were all planted, or I should say most of them were planted during the agricultural improvements of the 18th and 19th centuries, with the intention of either keeping stock in a field or away from crops. And to do that, those hedges that were planted would be laid, that is, cut through the stem and laid over at an angle and worked all the way along the hedge like that. Then stakes would have been put in to hold it, and then what's called a binding on top to make it tighter. The whole point of that was to create a living fence and stimulate new growth at the bottom of the plant, which will come up through the plants that have already been laid over, and the whole thing will become thick, bushy, and impenetrable to your sheep or your cattle or whatever it is that you're trying to keep away from your crops or in your pasture.
And of course, they're terrific for wildlife.
That is the major benefit nowadays, because most people tend to run with post and wire fencing. So most of what I do is for habitat creation, because what we're doing is we're causing the plant to regenerate at the base where it's thin, and will continue to get even thinner over time. And there's no cover for the small mammals, the amphibians, the reptiles and so on and so forth at that level if a plant's left to go to its own devices. So we're promoting new growth at the bottom, making it thick, dense and bushy, which is what all these little creatures want. They want comfort and safety away from predators. And all the other secondary benefits that we get from it are all great. We've got shelter for livestock on the leeward side of the hedge. It helps control water management, pollution in the soil, so forth. Everything, it benefits the insects, the butterflies, the bats use it as corridors for hunting and stuff like
that. So it makes a real difference. You can see the difference it makes.
The difference is enormous. It's exponential, really.
We're standing just at the entrance to Symington, and at one side you're going to be doing your conservation hedge laying here. At the other side of the road we've got what I suppose I would describe as a kind of conventional looking hedge, which has been cut back a bit. What's wrong with it?
That's an example of what we see pretty much throughout the British landscape, unfortunately, is that in the post-war period we obviously had a loss of manpower on the farms, people drifting away after the war. We also had the introduction of affordable hedge trimming devices, which people thought were the way forward, particularly with the loss of manpower, because it's quite a labour-intensive process, this. So people went over to mechanically cutting hedges, and we've had that happening now for the last 70 years, with the consequence that most of what we can see in the landscape around us is now thin in the bottom of the hedge, gapping out, which will increase over time. And eventually, with this continued flailing and cutting, the hedges will eventually stress themselves out and die out. And they'll die out over time in any case, but this is making it worse. So the only way we can actually retrieve that situation is to manage our hedges properly. This kind of cutting is really a control measure rather than a management measure for hedgerow benefit. You saw as I was going down there, I kept tension on it, and you could probably hear it tearing a little bit. And that's what you want. You don't want to be trying to cut right through the plant.
How are you getting on?
Oh, okay. It's about guessing which ones to take down, you know, and having a think about how the tree's going to lie, how far down it's going to go, and how big it is as well, how long it is. So can weave it in, I suppose.
Yeah, do you think you're getting to grips with it?
I think so. I'm trying to get my head around the idea that I'm knocking lumps out of this plant, but yet it's going to do it good. There's a bit of a paradox going on there.
It is. It kind of goes against the grain a wee bit.
It's a strange satisfaction. It's about just getting in there with this, a tool that I've never used before, a Yorkshire hook. And that's a bit of a lethal weapon, but yeah. No, it's great fun, actually.
Well, we tried this at home and we didn't do any of it right. But to be honest, the hedge really thickened up quite well. I think it's really resilient, so even if we do get it wrong, I think it'll probably keep going.
So my name is Lynn Bates. I'm the Nectar Network Coordinator, which is a Scottish Wildlife Trust-led project here in Ayrshire. And we're obviously helping out the pollinator-friendly Symington, which is a group here set up last year to obviously make things as pollinator-friendly as possible. So, yeah, that's what we're trying to learn these skills to do that.
And you've been doing a lot of work to help pollinators across the whole of Ayrshire, actually.
Yeah. So to give its full title, the Irvine to Girvan Nectar Network. So we've been working down the coast with landowners, with farmers, with the councils, with community groups, anyone really who's up for wanting to help pollinators, whether it's creating wildflower meadows, planting trees, planting hedges. We're really trying to obviously help our pollinators that need all the help they can.
And you can tell already that it is making a difference.
A huge difference, yes. We've been monitoring. We started last year doing a professional and citizen science monitoring on all the sites that we've created. And we're starting to see the results of that, of what we've been doing for the last 4 years. And our volunteers go out and regularly monitor the sites. So, yeah, it's going to take time, obviously, to build that up. But already, yeah, we're seeing that there's more flowers, there's more forage, there's more food. And also, obviously, it's about habitat and creating places where they can obviously nest as well, and they can rest as well as just getting the food. So it's everything.
How are you getting on?
I'm getting on fine. I'm finding it difficult to start with, but once you know what you're doing, it gets slightly easier, so practice makes perfect, I suppose.
By the end of the day, you'll be an expert and you'll be able to train others.
I don't know about that too much. I'll be quite happy if I get a pass.
So I've been teaching hedge laying courses with a colleague of mine, Mike Wade, and we've been doing these for the last 20 years, and we're now starting to see some beneficial outcomes from that, in as much as we've got little buds of new stage hedge layers throughout southern Scotland, and particularly we've got a cluster over here in Ayrshire and Dumfries and Galloway. So it's very encouraging to see, because one of the major problems we've got in the hedge laying community is getting young people and new people to come into the craft. So we are seeing the start of a, I can't quite call it a flourishing, but we are seeing the kind of nascent buzz of a renewal of hedge laying in Scotland.
Thanks to conservation hedge layer Graham Walker and Lynn Bates from the Scottish Wildlife Trust, as well as the group from Pollinator Friendly Symington.
I was a bit worried, you know, that I wouldn't be able to spot them, because I've not been to Symington before. Uh-huh. But apparently, if you drive along and you see a group of people with billhooks and axes at the side of the road, they're quite distinctive.
That's probably them.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, because I interviewed Graham. I think it was the Duke of Buccleuch's land. He was actually working on a hedge there, and it was a considerable hedge. There's not an awful lot of leeway.
Oh, no,
you know,
isn't.
You know, if you've had your porridge in the morning, you're looking at coppicing rather than hedge laying.
Well, that was their fear, actually. Yeah. One of the volunteers said, you know, I'm a bit worried that if I get involved with this, there'll be no hedge left.
Chopped to the ground. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, conservation work on the RRS Discovery and the discovery of a much older ship on Orkney.
And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you, as always. Let's have another listen. David John Chadwick and Carl Luke says he thinks the mystery sound is the sound of the Dunny Ghost.
You know what the Dunny Ghost
no,
is?
No, I haven't a clue.
Dunny's an old word for toilet.
Ah, okay, I get that. I can see that, yeah. He says, I attended the very successful Carl Luke Rotary Sportsman's Dinner last night. As I was a bit late to bed, this morning's dog walk will be a bit on the tardy side. Fair enough.
He goes on to say, children of our neighbouring town Lanark celebrate Whoopity Scoory next Friday. I've never heard of that.
No, I've never heard of it either.
Whoopity Scoory. If you know what Whoopity Scoory is, let us know. Denise and Phil say frosty start in Rothes. Reggie the Labrador's already been out in his winter jacket. Is today's mystery sound the winding of an old town clock that's in need of serious repair? Mm. We'll be ending up Ben Aiken tomorrow, so fingers crossed for some sunshine. Denise and Phil.
Alan Mark says, might the mystery sound be the kegs of beer being delivered to Beechgrove Studios? Oh, if only. Rather chilly here in West Lothian this morning.
It's the clinking of the champagne crates. That's what it is.
That's what it is, yeah. Get in touch if you want to have a guess. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give us a ring 0885 92950.
20 years ago, I made a series for Radio Scotland called Mountain Tales. Now, each programme featured one of Scotland's iconic hills and what it meant to the people who lived nearby. Shehalion in Perthshire is known as the Hill of the Fairy Folk. Now, the John Muir Trust own half the mountain and the other half is privately owned.
Hello.
Hello, Ian.
Mark Stephen, BBC.
How do you do?
Nice to meet you too. How are you?
Nervous hound.
Have your family been here long?
100 years and a bit.
All right.
I'll lead on.
Okay, thank you.
As I was saying earlier, Shehalion is part-owned by the John Muir Trust, but the other half is owned by Ian de Salle Terrier and his wife Rose, who live at Loch Garry House on the north side. Morning, noon and night, Shehalion is just out their window.
Well, Shehalion's up there across the loch actually being a reservoir, and Shehalion rises going up to the very pyramid-like peak.
Is there a particular time of year which is your personal favourite?
I love the autumn when all the birches are golden and yellow and the rowan trees are red, the leaves turned bright fiery red, and the bracken has gone golden brown. And very often we have lovely clear blue skies. and you hear the stags roaring during the rutting season. It's the magical time of year.
Is there one particular day or experience or time or moment that you can think of that it's almost like a sort of mental postcard of Schiehallion, something that would make sense to somebody listening to this in the other side of the world, you know, that describes what it's like?
Well, I think it would be to do with skiing, really. The way I used to go up was to go up from the Braeside Foss end, which is where the John Muir Trust are based now, and I would carry my skis. And then I'd come down Ptarmigan Corrie, which is very steep indeed, with a great lip of snow that you have to negotiate, climb up to the top again, and then do the gallows run. Gallows, because it's just about as near vertical as snow will hold. I think one of the days when I did that would certainly be the most enduring memory of my enjoyment of Schiehallion.
Is that the same for you, or you picked another time?
I was stalking one day on the mountain on Schiehallion, and the person I was with had gone back down the track for a Land Rover to collect a stag. And sitting on the trailer of the Land Rover, he found a very ancient-looking man wrapped up in multiple layers of clothing with a white face. And he established, when he got some words out of the old man, that he had come from Melbourne to die on our holy mountain. And he had been sleeping on the mountain for a week in sub-zero temperatures. And after a week, he decided that God didn't want him to die after all. So he saw these people down, which was us, further down the hill. He'd seen them the day before, in fact. And he said his legs wouldn't work that day. But this day, his legs had worked and he'd managed to get to the trailer. So I drove him as fast as I could down to the doctor's. Meanwhile, he was beginning to thaw out a bit. And when he got down, he was looked after, but he's told the policeman that he left his luggage on the mountain under a rock. Well, if anybody knows Schiehallion, there's a lot of rocks on Schiehallion. They spent 2 weeks looking for his luggage and eventually found it on the next door hill.
I'm conscious of the fact we're talking about a mountain, which is a pretty big thing, but if you own a mountain or half a mountain even, do you feel protective of it?
We feel very protective of it, and for the animals and plant life on it, we're very, very attached to it emotionally.
Rose and Ian de Salle-Letellier with the stories of Schiehallion. If you'd like to hear more about the Hill of the Wee Folk, look for the Scotland Outdoors podcast available on BBC Sounds. And I hadn't heard that in 20 years. You know what I found really remarkable? I'd forgotten the story of the man who'd gone to the mountain to die. Mm-hmm. And I, for the life of me, I can't figure out how I'd forgotten the story.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a really lovely podcast, well worth a listen. Yeah. Such nice stories of even, you know, people who are young at the time who tend to take everything for granted, you know, and they're not impressed by much. But camping quite near the top and waking up to amazing sunrises that's actually stuck with them forever.
Aye, quite.
Really, really nice. And we've had some correspondence as well.
Sylvia Tullock says, another beautiful episode, appreciated in Sydney, Australia.
Anna Smith says, this is an exceptionally beautiful part of the world and somewhere I feel very lucky to have been able to see. And she's in French Polynesia. But she says, despite this, your podcast made me feel a little homesick for the first time in over a year. It was a joy to listen to. Schiehallion is one of those mountains we've always left until later. After this podcast, it may become our first ascent when we come home in July.
She says, it was also lovely hearing Dr. Brenda Gibson's voice again. She treated her own son 28 years ago. I didn't know then that she was a fellow mountain lover, but her comparison of the recovery process with an ascent was absolutely spot on.
Yeah, really lovely listen. Now, we were also discussing Whoopity Scooty.
Whoopity Scooty, which we never heard of.
So but. Producer Helen has done a bit of digging around, extensive research, she tells us. She says it's a traditional festival dating from the early 19th century observed by people in Lanark on the 1st 1st of March to celebrate the approach of spring. Local children gather around the local St Nicholas Kirk, where at 6 p.m. the wee bell is rung. This is the starting sign for the children to run around the church in a clockwise direction, making noise and swinging paper balls and strings above their heads as they run.
They go on to say it's no longer a race for safety reasons. Pah! And to increase fairness for the younger participants. Young kids have got to realise that the world is not a fair place. After three laps, they scramble for coins thrown by members of the community council who host the event. The community council also hosts a Whoopity Scooty storytelling festival and art workshops after the event until the 7th of March. That's a cracking thing. I'd never heard of it.
No, I've never heard of it either. It sounds great, actually. And who doesn't want to run around looking for coins that people are throwing? Fabulous.
They used to do, certainly when I was a kid in Bowness, scrambles at weddings and things like that. But apparently they did it in Fitty too, which is just, you know, at the foot of the D.
Mm-hmm.
Foot D. That's the posh name for it. They used to do it there. My grandfather, remember, he told me that they used to heat the money on a shovel on the fire. Throw it out and they watch the kids burning their fingers. See, it was a tougher life in those days.
An evil streak to them, I think.
No. It's what they did in those days.
Okay.
Anyway, coming up, I went to a tatty farm where they have seed potatoes galore. I mean, absolutely all over the place. And we're going to be hearing about a fishing boat for Forces veterans.
But we are fair tricket because it's quite light. No, we're no longer sitting in the dark at 7 o'clock.
Although I was smiling when we went. We ran inside, made a cup of tea, came back out again. You know, that comment earlier about the barrels of beer being delivered to BBC Aberdeen. Okay, just to give you an insight into the conditions here, I went to open a jar of Kenko coffee there, and it's been there so long, it is a solid lump of coffee. There is no granulation at all. Nothing.
Are you moaning? Are you saying
no,
we're not well looked after here?
No.
Yeah.
Looked after.
We've also got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have a listen. Alistair and Elgin says, hey, this is easy. It's the old wooden shed I demolished last weekend. Unfortunately, the replacement has a composite roof. Still dreaming of owning
Alistair,
a rusty, red, wrinkly tin roof. Mm-hmm. Cold and frosty in Elgin. Plan to complete the new fence round the veg plot and a log store this weekend. Who needs to go to the gym?
Dougie and Anion Cooper say, hello, peeps. Good morning from a chilly Cooper. Is the mysteriousness this week the clock mechanism of Big Ben? We went to the Yellow Butterflies last week. Wonderful exhibition. And Anya dipped into the Sellerdike pool. Where are you sending us this week?
We'll have a think. Donald Mackey is feeding coos in Forfar. It's -5. He says, is it the English fans coming to Scotland with their bells on?
Good question. Drew H says, good morning from a misty in moonlight Malig. Is the mystery sound an old meal mill turning? There are no correct answers so far, but Drew, you're on the right track.
Good guesses. Yeah. Outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address. Text us 80295, or if you fancy a blether with Sky, give us a ring on 0808592950.
The RSS Discovery is, I would say, a pretty crucial part of Dundee's heritage. It was the ship that carried Captain Scott and Shackleton to the Antarctic in the early 1900s. Inevitably, given its age, it's now in need of some urgent repairs. Dundee Heritage Trust, who looked after the Discovery, have just received £1.4 million from the National Heritage Memorial Fund to undertake some much-needed conservation work. Emma Halford Forbes is director of the Trust.
The Discovery was built in 1901, launched in 1901, right here in Dundee, and was the first dedicated Antarctic research vessel. So it's incredibly exciting that we have that link with Dundee. I think the thing for us that's exciting over and above that link is the fact that the ship then went south on a couple of journeys, and both of those journeys creating scientific material, creating scientific methods that are still used by scientists today. And the baselines for the scientific research that they did over 100 years ago is still used by scientists today.
I, every time I come here, I walk these decks and I try to imagine what it must be like in perpetual darkness, you know, because you're in the southern Atlantic, essentially. You know, the rigging is all iced up, there's snow on the ground, the footing is slick with dog poo because there's dogs all over the place and livestock. Tough life.
when the ship left New Zealand, it was dangerously overloaded with supplies and sheep and you name
coal
it.
And everything else.
Yeah, to keep them going for who knew how long, because they didn't really know what was going to happen. And of course, the Discovery did get stuck in the ice for longer than they had expected. So it's difficult sometimes to imagine what that would have been like. And we're hoping that we can get in the future, in our upcoming redevelopment project, that we can get some interpretation to give people an idea of how busy the deck would have been for those men as they were setting off from New Zealand on their way to Antarctica. What we're looking at here is one of the stanchions that needs to be replaced as part of this project. And the stanchions are the upright, like the upright bit on your fence. This one here has a lovely hole in it that had been stuffed with newspapers from the 1990s and masticked over and painted. But the issue is when you have a hole like that in an upright, the water gets down to the decks underneath, and it means that those long bits of wood that we call longitudinals along the side of the ship get water into them as well. And that's the situation that we're in now.
My name's Jim Mitchell. I'm the conservation engineer on the restoration project to the Discovery.
Where are we at the moment in relation to, you know, the sort of geography of the ship?
OK, we're as far astern as you can go, and we're just below the upper deck. We call this the sail locker, but it's actually, if you look around you, you can see that the ship curves and tapers in towards the stern itself.
And you can see an extensive amount of damage. I mean, that those timbers are well rotted. This was designed to go into the ice, so it's not one thickness of hull. It's probably effectively laminated in different directions. Mm-hmm. The timbers that we can see on our side are massive. Mm-hmm. You can see the damage there. You've really no idea what's behind that, though.
No, we don't. Just looking through that opening, which was actually the old opening from the toilet that used to be on the upper deck, you can just see the thickness of the hull at that point.
Yeah.
About
2 feet?
Yeah, it's about that.
This might sound like a daft question, but how much of this damage is a result of the fact that this thing's backside wasn't wet enough for quite a long time? It was out of the water.
Yeah, the ship's been in dry dock now without water for a few decades, and it's suffered considerably. A wooden ship starts to deform when it's not in its element, and in particular, in this case, where we've got a lot of deck leakage, so fresh water is not good for timber. Salt water has a preservative effect. Obviously, we don't have that. Even if the dry dock was flooded, the River Tay is a fast-flowing river, and the salt content is quite low, even at high tide. So we have to deal with that challenge when we come to it. But the first thing to do is obviously make the repairs to the timbers to get it back to a condition where it can float again.
Two questions. Where are you going to get the timbers this size?
Yeah.
And where are you going to get the people to actually fit them? Because I mean, it's a seriously skilled job.
Sourcing native oak nowadays, which would have been done at the time for when the ship was built, they would have sourced the oak from probably within 50, 100 miles of here. That's very difficult nowadays, but we are using a sawmill in Perthshire who can provide lots of the smaller section, like the beams above your head. These are fracturing through stress. We'll source them locally. We'll try and source as much timber as we can locally.
My name is Lynn Short, and I am Dundee City Council spokesperson for Culture, Sport and History.
Very easy to see this as being a historical artefact, the Discovery. Fantastic, wonderful to have it in the city, but it is also a huge part of the cultural life of the city, almost the DNA of the city now.
Yeah, twofold, actually. If you wander just a stone's throw from here, you'll actually see some standing stones. They're made of granite, and it is the hull of the Discovery, and it's actually where she was launched from. But beyond that, in the 80s, the city's fathers at that time decided it was time to come home. So she came home, and since she was here, she really has made a difference to the culture of the city.
Well, this is whaling technology.
Very much so, yes. Again, whaling is very much part of the city, but it's also part of how we change the way that the world is moving. I learnt recently that whales and what they kind of corral around us is better for the environment than planting maybe 100 trees. So they're so important. And, you know, maybe it's a wee bit of it's a bit of a cliche to say that we should do a little bit of restoration, because we were a city that very much was about whaling. My own great-great-great-grandfather was a whaler. But yeah, maybe we should be talking about these things and saying, you know, this is why we don't do whaling anymore, or shouldn't do whaling in places around the world. I do have another little bit of personal history. If you look up to the crow's nest, the lookout, they had to replace it. And believe it or not, my uncle is now a cooper who lives in Fife. And he was the cooper that
the wee cooper that
did
that lives in Fife.
Yes, uh-huh. So my uncle was the cooper that actually put together that that remake of the crow's nest.
How exciting is this as a project? I mean, I know you've done heaps of stuff that's really interesting, but I mean, this project particularly.
Well, you know, I'm probably getting near retirement age, but I think it's probably one of the most exciting jobs and most challenging jobs that we've had. The fact that there's so many unknowns about it is more interesting than scary. I think it's quite a challenge, and we're looking forward to it.
A literal voyage of discovery.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Conservationist and restorer Jim Mitchell there, and we also heard from Emma Halford Forbes, who's director of the Dundee Heritage Trust, and local councillor Lynn Short, all on board the RRS Discovery in Dundee. It's not easy to say that.
No, too many S's. when you just go along the road to HMS Unicorn, they're experiencing very similar issues, yes. Aren't they? Rotten timber, and where do you get the wood to carry out the repairs and the skill required to do it?
I'm trying to remember that years ago they did the restoration of the Golden Hall in Stirling Castle, and I want to say that the oak came from the Noida area. I'm not sure, but I mean, getting timbers that size to actually do the roof in that case, but getting timbers, you know, that size is extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, certainly when I was at Unicorn recently, they were talking about whether in the future they would have to think about planting their own trees to ensure they had a ready supply for the future.
You may have to wait a while.
A long time, sure. Yeah.
As you may have seen earlier this week on the BBC Scotland News website, they have discovered a shipwreck washed ashore on the island of Sandy in Orkney. Now, the use of wooden pegs to hold it together suggests it could be as old as the 16th century. Joining us to tell us more about what happens to a find like this is Ben Saunders, who's a senior marine archaeologist with Wessex Archaeology in Edinburgh. Ben, thanks for joining us. I know you've seen the images from Sandy. Any idea what kind of ship this is, what its origin was?
Morning. It's difficult to tell just from the images. As you say, the type of construction, the carvel style construction rather than clinker construction, that sort of comes in within the late 16th century, introduced from the Mediterranean. And it really goes all the way through until the early 20th century with the swapping out of wooden ships for iron and steel. But the construction technique carries all the way through. There are different small sort of aspects to different ships that you can tell, get a rough idea of the date of the ship from. But the best way to get a decent date on the ship is to do scientific dating, either through radiocarbon dating, although that's less reliable once you get into the post-medieval and modern period, or through dendrochronology, so tree ring dating.
So does that mean removing it from where it is now?
Tricky. It's quite a large piece of timber, and the quantity of oak is probably between 3 and 6 tons worth of oak. So what would be a better option would be to cut samples out of it. For dendrochronology dating, what you need is essentially like a disc sliced off one of the, or several of the timbers, 3 to 5 centimetres thick. And what you're looking for is a minimum of 50 tree rings, but ideally, from speaking to the experts, you need 80 to 100 for better. And you're looking at 8 to 10 samples for each sort of phase of the thing you're sampling, which in this case, you potentially would want 8 to 10 samples from the frames, the rib timbers of the ship, and 8 to 10 samples from the planking.
It's been suggested that, you know, that what's washed up on the beach essentially was at one stage underneath the seabed, and it's, you know, storm activity has kind of flushed it loose and it's washed up on the shore. Is that kind of thing quite common?
It is relatively common. I mean, if you look, Scotland has a huge amount of sea area, and there are a vast number of wrecks that are currently unknown or certainly unlocated with any level of certainty. within that area. So there's a large amount of potential material out there. Part of the issue is that with the impacts of climate change, one of the things that's been identified is the potential for increased storminess and therefore increased wave action. And so it's potentially true that this may become more frequent and more common over the coming years. Historic Environment Scotland have produced a guide to the potential impacts of climate change on the historic environment, which has an extensive section on maritime culture and the potential for damage to wrecks on that. So it has the potential to get more common, essentially.
When you look at the pictures, it looks quite clean. There doesn't look to be a lot of marine algae or anything like that on it. Is that surprising?
It is. I think it led people to think that it might actually have been something that's on the beach originally and it's just been exposed and by the removal of sediment rather than being washed up. Although we have recently heard that it has moved a little bit along the beach. So part of the problem is, oak has a neutral buoyancy when in water. So even though that is a very heavy bit of timber, once it's submerged, it can sort of just bump along the seabed. It is a good testament to the builders of the ship that it's still quite structurally integral as a piece. So it is relatively structurally intact at the moment. Obviously, if there's a storm in the future or any other sort of fairly hefty event, then it might break free again.
The fact that it's not put together with nails or copper rivets or anything else of the kind, it's actually put together with wooden pegs, what does that tell you?
So that's a very common practice with a lot of ships during the post-medieval period, largely because iron is expensive, firstly, and it's heavy. And so to save weight and to save money, you want to use trenails, these wooden pegs. But also, they are very, very good at pulling the ship together, essentially. So as you knock them into the timbers, they're slightly sharpened. So they pull the timbers together, and then as the ship's in the water, they swell up, and they basically hold the whole hull together. They're incredibly strong, much stronger than iron or copper would be for this size of ship, certainly. So again, it does tell us a bit about the probable date of the wreck, but not enough to sort of narrow it down. And it's a practice that's quite common throughout European shipbuilding at this time.
But there is a chance it could be hundreds of years old.
Yeah, absolutely. And that we'll only be able to find that out if it is possible to get samples to dendrochronology. But certainly it's a really interesting piece of wreck. The population of Sandy have done a fantastic job in both reporting it to the local archaeologist, the local council archaeologist, and in terms of making sure that enough photographs and other material has been recovered already, so that if anything does occur to it through storms or anything before any work can be done, if it can be done, that there's a lot of information already for people to look at.
Ben, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's been really interesting.
No problem at all. Thank you very much.
No problem. Ben Saunders, a senior marine archaeologist with Wessex Archaeology in Edinburgh there.
Yeah, one to watch. Let's see what they discover.
Yeah. Well, you saw the damage on the Discovery that was caused by the fact that, you know, essentially you ship that's supposed to be in salt water that was in dry dock for many, many years and what have you. They don't like it.
No.
They do not like it at all. And fresh water's really bad for them.
Yeah. It'll be wanting to get itself back into the sea.
Great.
We are, of course, broadcasting to you today from the Granite City. The personal recollections of those involved in the granite industry in Aberdeen are at the heart of a new exhibition at the Art Gallery. Now, tools and machinery used in the quarrying process are also on display at the Art Gallery, as well as a film featuring some of the last generation of apprentices trained to use them. Douglas Campbell from the Aberdeen City Heritage Trust showed me round the exhibition.
So this is a polishing machine that was developed in Aberdeen called a Seton polisher, and basically it's a type of device that you fit different polishing heads onto, and then that goes down onto the top of the granite surface, and with different abrasives that allows the granite to be taken from a rough surface to a highly polished finish.
That must have been a game changer then when this was invented.
Yeah, polishing machines really came in a mechanised form really from the 1830s onwards, steam powered initially, but then as the century went on, they transferred over to electricity towards the turn of the century. But yes, it markedly speeded up the process of polishing materials, an activity that was really a hand process until mechanisation came in. And in actual fact, it was really only the very wealthy that could afford to have something which was polished granite, because it was all handwork at the time.
And you've actually got lots of examples of the tools that were used in the industry as part of this exhibition. Is there anything in particular that has caught your eye?
I'm particularly interested in the pneumatic tool. Pneumatic tools were something which were imported as a technology from the United States towards the end of the 19th century. And again, it made the difference between hand chiselling and working with a pneumatic tool, which made work much faster for the skilled craftsmen that were using them.
One of the really lovely things about this exhibition is that you actually hear from some of those who worked in the industry itself.
Indeed, yes. We're very grateful for the funding we received from Historic Environment Scotland to allow us to carry out the interviews with the 12 participants. That was a really helpful part of the process, and it's a fundamental part of the exhibition, Voices of the Granite Industry. I think there's nothing like the insight you can get from people who've previously worked in the industry. And they've actually illuminated some of the film footage as well. For example, we saw that people in some of the film footage were wearing rubber on their fingers. And one of the interviewees explained that the tools were so cold in the workshops that sometimes we would stick to your hands in the winter. So the workers actually got inner tubes from tyres and took those and put them on their fingers to prevent that happening, and also just to generally protect their fingers. So there's a sense, really, that it was really quite a hard existence in the workshops.
It definitely sounds it. And you've got a lovely story from a chap who started, well, from his first day, really.
That's right, yes. I mean, obviously, it was hard, hard work. And one of the participants was explaining what his first day was like on the industry. And he was basically given a hammer and told to hammer a bit of granite for the whole day. And he got home and his mother asked him, well, how did your first day go? And he said, I'm dying. But obviously things got better as he got used to the strength and the physical exertion that was involved in it.
I mean, it seems almost like a daft question, but just explain the huge significance that granite has had for Aberdeen.
I mean, Aberdeen is renowned worldwide for its granite, and that's partly to do with the buildings in the city, but it's also partly to do with the memorial work that was exported all over the world, particularly in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So it was a big, big industry for the city, and it was a part of the heart of the city and the city, the way the city operated. So incredibly important as an industry for the city, and it's something that I think we need to find more out about and make folk aware of the rich heritage that they have in the city. We're surrounded by very high quality architecture. We're surrounded by all the memorials and cemeteries across the city. So we like to take any opportunity that we have just to expose that and make that available to people so that they can better understand the heritage in the city.
And of course, we've got one of the biggest granite buildings in the world, Marshall College, of course, which is stunning.
That's right, yes. I'm not sure that anybody's actually gone and physically measured, but yes.
We're claiming it anyway.
It's claimed to be the second largest, that's right. And it is a very fine building, obviously. Marshall has a whole history behind it, but certainly that frontage onto Broad Street, the Alexander Marshall Mackenzie frontage, is a particularly stunning example of Gothic architecture in the city.
And the granite was exported around the world, but also the workers from Aberdeen travelled around the world too.
That's right. Yes, the skills travelled. There was a big influx of people from Aberdeen to Bahrain, Vermont, to work in the granite industry there. Some of who worked as seasonal workers, but some who actually stayed and established their own companies there. But there was also workers who went from the northeast to Australia to work on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. So they were involved in the granite cladding for the pylons of the bridge. So 30 workers went over and worked on that project over there.
Generally, this was an industry dominated by men, but of course, during the war, women got involved too, and you do have some information about that in your exhibition.
That's right, yes. During World War I, and particularly, the Imperial War Museum took photographs in Aberdeen of women at the tools in some of the yards. So that's fascinating just to see how the women were able to step in and carry out some of the duties that men had been doing until they were sent off to the war.
And what about the quarries now? I mean, we still know where they are, dotted around Aberdeen, but is there still a fascination with what's happened to them?
I think so, and there are still quarries operating, but they're mainly crushing stone for aggregate or for decorative work. They're really, in terms of building stone and monumental stone, most of that's imported these days. But there are still quarries who occasionally do extract pieces of what they call dimension stone for building on a case-by-case basis. And an example of that would be at Kemeny, where one of the faces was opened up and stone taken for the construction of the Scottish Parliament buildings.
Well, that was Douglas Campbell from the Aberdeen City Heritage Trust there, and Voices from the Granite Industry, the exhibition runs until the 14th of April at Aberdeen Art Gallery.
Yeah, it's a really interesting exhibition.
Sorry, here we keep on hearing a woodpecker. There's a woodpecker across in the trees across there, but needless to say, it won't do it now.
No, it won't.
Come on, do it.
It was very active a few minutes ago.
There. That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, you say
nice.
It's a very interesting exhibition.
Yeah, really interesting exhibition. And they've got a nice display of all the different types of granite that you can see, because I suppose we associate it in Aberdeen with being silver or grey, Silver City. But there's lots of peaches and pinks. I think there's an emerald granite as well. What stunning colours.
There are two buildings, Coast Guard houses, former Coast Guard houses, and they're just like cattle sheds now, just beside the Lochastrath Beg, towards the beach side, and they're made of a blue granite.
Most unusual. Yeah,
most
very
unusual. Yeah. And Ron, our audio supremo, was saying that polishing machine apparently used to be known as a Jenny Lind, because when the arm went out and worked on a rotary pattern, effectively, like almost like wiping a kitchen surface, it made a skirling sound, which probably sounded like the opera singer Jenny Lind on a 78 record.
Flattering comparison.
Well, it's not terribly flattering comparison. And the story about the guys using bicycle tubes, you know, inner tubes, you know, to protect their fingers and things. Years ago, I had a program about slate quarrying, and the guys there saying they were working splitting slates all day, and the hacks in their hands got so bad that they would fill the hacks in on their hands with molten wax from candles.
Oh.
Tough life.
Very, very tough, yeah. I'm Dean. I can see why you might think that.
Quite. Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Sitting right next to me here at Beech Grove is Rachel Stewart. That fire's dying. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, it's also incredibly smoky. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We ask every week, where do you listen to this? Get in touch, which is what Paul Main did. He says, I wrote to your magnificent programme 3.5 years ago to tell you how one of your midweek podcasts, one featuring Philippa Forrester, had impacted my life and caused me to start studying for a Master's in Sustainable Mountain Development at UHI. At the time, I was working as an accountant in central London and had been for 35 years. Since then, an awful lot has happened, and I thought it appropriate to share, given your programme can take its fair share of credit.
This is lovely. He says, the first thing is that I passed my course, but perhaps more profoundly, my family and I have relocated to Northern Scotland, and I'm now a Deer Policy Officer for Nature Scot. I have never been happier, and the combination of the drip feeding of your weekly shows and that one podcast has encouraged a complete change of life and a return home. I'm originally from Aberdeen. I just thought I would thank you again for the impact of your programme. Thanks again, and do keep up the good work, says Paul Main.
Excellent.
It's time for a mystery sound again. Let's have a listen.
Okay. The mystery sound we want you to identify is that clattering noise, not the sound of the woodpecker in the background.
We're just showing off now.
Yeah.
Davy G says, is the mystery sound an old ship, perhaps RRS Discovery bobbing in the water?
John Arthur on the Isle of Bute says, damp here today. We think the mystery sound is a mill wheel turning and grinding, which is good. Jolan Lithgow says, a gate for separating a flock of sheep.
Dave on the train from Milton Keynes to Dingwall to see family says, morning, is today's mystery sound a pub landlord opening his cellar door and rolling barrels in? Clearly we are making people think of alcohol this morning.
I don't know why. Rick in Cumbria says, kegs of Scottish brew being lowered into Mark's cellar. Again, I wish, Rick.
Stuart from Elgin says, I think the mystery sound could be a machine sorting plastic and tin can recycling.
It is a machine sorting, but not that. Mike and Tara out with the dugs, -5, he says. Says, the mystery sound is my partner loading the dishwasher after Sunday lunch. She goes for the pilot in and hope method of loading.
That's the way I should go as well.
We should see my youngest daughter. She kind of lobs it in from the far side of the kitchen. Ruth in Glasgow says, was it the stations on that ship but with added bird cries? Malcolm for Collentry thought it might be a drum solo by a jazz drummer. And Craig and Bearsden thought it might be a log shed making wooden logs for cosy fires.
Good guesses. You've still got time to get your guesses in. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. You can text us 80295 or you can ring us 08085 929500.
One of the great joys, you know, sort of one of the calendar markers every year is actually digging up some new tatties, putting on a fresh boiling and what have you, and then having them slathered in butter with a wee chop of chives across the top too. It's a wonderful thing. So, this reminds me that it's nearly time to get your seed potatoes planted. Now, you might very well get your seed potatoes from Andrew Ski. Andrew is an organic seed potato grower and supplier at Octa House near Dundee, and I met up with him at his farm.
We're packing seed potatoes into small nets here for going out to gardeners. We've got what we think one of the widest range of varieties, and we're selling them direct to gardeners over the internet. So we do have fairly small runs. It's not a big machine. Some of the bigger companies have got big machines that are fully automatic. This one's just does them at the scale that we need them done.
It looks like a whole series of letterboxes, and every so often the letterboxes flip open and spit out a tatty. Uh-huh. But, you know, is that different varieties are coming out or different sizes?
No, each of the eight boxes will have a certain weight of potatoes in it, and the computer decides which combination of boxes. It opens maybe two or three and drops them onto a conveyor, and that will be as close as possible to the exact weight of the pack that we're doing today.
What are gardeners actually looking for in terms of varieties? I mean, is it stuff that is disease resistant? Is it stuff for taste? Is it, you know, is the weird and wonderful?
We got into it really through, we were doing organic potatoes, varieties that were suitable for growing organically. And I always think that they're also the most suitable varieties for the garden because they've got natural resistance. You don't need to worry quite so much about blight or other diseases. So that's one attribute. But the garden market's very traditional as well. There's a lot of old varieties that are still in big demand. And quite often these varieties are not ideal for growing organically, so we don't do them organically. But then there are old varieties that have got extremely good resistance. They've really stood the test of time because they're robust. So varieties like Golden Wonder, you know, very rarely takes rots or blight.
We're standing in front of rows and rows and rows of boxes, and they're all labelled and what have you. So Sarpo Arcona, Blue Danube, Carolus Cara, Casablanca, Sarpo Keefley, Foremost, Gatsby, Golden Wonder, Heidi Red. How many varieties do you actually stock?
We've got about 60 varieties in stock here this year. We grow most of them ourselves, so maybe 40 we grow ourselves, and then we've got a few others that we buy from other farmers in this area. We're right in the centre of where seed potatoes are grown, so if we've got another farmer growing pink for apple, then we don't bother growing it ourselves, we just get it from him because he's good at it. There'll be a dozen varieties that we get from other farmers.
Are you still able to export to Europe, Northern Ireland?
No. I was sending potatoes to Germany, Sweden and Ireland was the biggest part of my business prior to Brexit. But that's stopped completely now. We can't send seed potatoes anywhere. Wow. Well, this year we can get them into Northern Ireland. That's a little door that has opened this year.
Where all do Scottish seed potatoes go then?
Well, the bigger scale producers are sending a lot of potatoes to North Africa. So Egypt is one country that's probably half of all seed potato exports. And obviously that's not affected by Brexit. So that business is continuing as it always has done. Other countries along the North African coast as well, Morocco, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Syria has taken some in the past, but maybe not so much right now.
I am smiling because I'm trying, you know, each of those countries you mentioned, I have a mental image, none of which includes tatty fields, you know, but they obviously can grow them.
They can. I think in Morocco, they've got a bit of rain coming in from the Atlantic, so they've got a reasonable climate there. In Egypt, it's nearly all irrigated by water from the Nile, so they've built huge irrigation channels, tapping water off from the Nile further upstream and then out into the, more or less into what would have been desert. But
have you been to see it?
I have, many years ago. I did go as a wee exploration one time. Uh-huh. Some parts of Egypt's very mechanised, but other parts, small-scale producers, they're moving 50 kilo bags about on their backs and You know, we don't move 50 kilo bags in this country manually anymore. We've got a huge order on now. You'll maybe have heard that the AHDB Potatoes was kind of disbanded a couple years ago, and they used to do the marketing of potatoes. One of the projects that they used to do that we were really interested in was supplying seed potatoes to school children. So they were sending 15,000 packs of seed potatoes out to 15,000 classrooms in the country, and that was just going to, the project was just going to be shelved. So we've adopted it, and we're trying to get this project going again. Well, we've done it on a small scale last year, a bit more this year, and we're hoping to get it back up to speed again. So
They were doing 15,000 bags a day. How many are you doing?
I think this year we're going to do 8,000 classrooms.
So basically they get a bag of tatties, they get a patch of ground or whatever it is, it might be just containers or whatever, and they plant up the tatties and grow their own tatties?
They're just doing them in containers. It can be done in the classroom and then it can be moved out into the into the yard in the school once they're growing. Tend to give them early varieties so that they grow quickly, bulk up quickly. We give them two varieties, a red one and a white one, so that when they come to harvest them, and if they've lost the labels, then they can still hopefully match up the two different varieties. The seeds go out to them next week, and they'll be encouraged to put them on the windowsill and chit them for 3 or 4 weeks, and then plant them before the Easter holidays, and then obviously they've got to harvest them before they go off on their summer break.
I can see the value of that to the school children. What's the value of that to you?
The value of it to the potato industry is that people just know about potatoes, and it's a thing that they're familiar with, and hopefully they'll go on to eat them through their lives. We've put together this package for teachers that they can use it to kind of help with teaching maths, biology, you know, all aspects of the curriculum. We can kind of relate it to growing potatoes, and it just gives them something different to do. The children love it. The teachers love it as well because they've got material available for them.
Precisely.
Andrew Ski of Ski Organics and Potato House. And later on today, Andrew's going to be at Kirriemuir for Kirri Tatty Day. You can pick up your seed tatties for this year and find out all about the different varieties. There's a link in our website, apparently.
Yeah, there's also the Tarland Tatties Day today as well. It's at the McRobert Hall, and our producer, who's a big fan of that event, says get there early because they'll be disappearing.
They go very, very quickly.
Yeah. Have you tried the Shetland Black?
I have, as a matter of fact. I wasn't hugely impressed by it.
Yeah, it's a spectacular colour.
Yeah.
Purple.
Yeah.
And you kind of hope that it's going to be purple when you boil a tatty, but I think it just turns into normal tatty colour.
I can't remember what I did. We were for dinner last Saturday, and I put a pot of tatties on. Mm-hmm. And there must have been one tatty in the bag that was different to the rest. I didn't notice it when I was peeling the tatties. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, within literally 10 minutes of the tatties going on at the bile, mm-hmm. one had gone through the brie.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, it had gone soupy. Now, the rest of them were okay, mm-hmm. so something had dissolved in there.
Some folk are quite particular about the kind of tatties they like, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just buy anything. Now...
You surprise me.
A fundraising campaign is underway for a fishing boat to be docked at Loch Inch, specifically for veterans and serving personnel of the armed forces. Tony Brown, who runs Forces Manor, it's an accommodation facility for those linked to the services, says the hand-built vessel will be named after a passionate fly fisher who was well known in Kincraig. He told me more about this fundraising campaign and why it means so much to him.
We launched it a week ago, and it's Veterans for Fishing. As far as we know, it is the first fishing boat for veterans and members of the armed forces in Britain. And so far, we've raised enough to pay for the deposit of the boat. And what we'll do is, the idea is the boat will be moored at Loch Inch Water Sports. And so people can come down, take the boat out, fish on the loch all year round. We've obtained a permit from the Laird of Dunacton Estate, so it's all official and above board. And it's just so we can offer people somewhere to just come and spend a day. I don't fish myself, but I know the benefits of it, and people love this environment here. And you can gain so much mental health if you can relax in an environment like Kincraig. And so those that are suffering the stresses of, again, PTSD, those that are just regular soldiers that are finding they need somewhere to escape, having a boat that's dedicated to them in an area like this, it's just, for us, a no-brainer that it's a perfect way to help people and offer a service that's probably not been done before. In fact, we know it's not been done before. So we have a GoFundMe page, and we're asking for people just to donate for the construction of the boat and then to get it launched. And hopefully we'll achieve that by April, because that's when the boat's ready. It's being made, so it's being handmade at the moment.
Yeah, so it's a handmade boat. Who's making it?
It's a guy called Nicholas down in Wakefield in England. And he, when I found him, I think just through the internet, when I told him what the nature of the project is, he immediately said, look, we'll do this cheaper than we would normally do it, and we'll deliver it up there for free. So it's a fiberglass boat made with wooden or oak furnishings on the top of it. Six people can sit in the boat, so you can have two or three fishing at a time. But I just think you could sit out here all day. We did have a couple of guys come and fish, and they banked fish. But it's not always that easy around here, because you can't find good spots to get, and then you can't get the car close, and there's all that. So by doing this as a boat fish in tow with Locking Sports Sports, which does attract forces, they come and do canoeing here and all those sort of sports, I think this is just that extra element. But I think it's just like a special element for Forces Manor to have something that, you know, helps them.
It's flat calm today. The water's actually barely moving, though there are three swans gliding along here. It just feels so tranquil, doesn't it?
It does. And even though the A9 and the main railway line to London is just like half a mile away, you can ignore it. I never ever went out fishing with Marion, who the boat's being named after, Marion Ramage, who she became like an adopted foster grandmother or whatever. I adopted her rather than the other way around. But she was famous for her fishing, and she would be on this lock every day that she could. And I never actually went in the boat with her, but, you know, I've often looked out and thought, what was it? So I will go out in this boat, I will, although I prefer my fish coming from the chip shop, but still, we'll see. But there is that tranquility, and like you say, look at it, it's clear, it's not moving. You can hear road noise, but it just goes. And you'll be out there anyway. You won't hear that noise as well anyway.
It doesn't really interfere, does it?
It doesn't, no.
And Marion used to own what is now Forces Manor.
Yes, her and her husband and daughter and son-in-law bought the Ossian Hotel in 1972 and soon turned it into one of the most popular and respected hotels in the Highlands, more so for its restaurant. And she once fished for Scotland on behalf of, although she was English, the local angling team were doing a competition. They ran a player missing or whatever, and she was actually called in because she was that well known. The local gillies would go out fishing with her because she just took a passion to the sport of fly fishing here. And so for me, having the honour of knowing this lady, who just meant so much to us, to be able to put a boat back on this lot, because she had her own boat, and call it the Marion, was just, it's kind of like special. It means a lot.
How did you meet her?
The first time I met her was at Aviemore train station. I was literally, through different reasons, was sent up here from growing up in Chun's home from the age of 7 months. And it was all arranged, and the home had found a hotel that would look after us. Not many would look after a 12-year-old child on his own who's coming from a children's home. I don't think in these days that would be allowed. But anyway, after the 500-mile journey on my own, I wasn't scared or nothing. I was just like, kind of like, whatever. She met me at the Aviemore train station. And she only took one look at this skinny wreck. Let's get it over, get some food into it. Because, you know, we didn't eat that much at this home that I was in. We did, but it was all... And I instantly bonded with her. And I was on a gliding course. She'd take me to the glider each day, bring me back. And I was always in the kitchen with her. She's keeping an eye on me most of the time. But she was just this fantastic lady. And she was also in the forces. Her husband was a captain in the Gurkhas, and they used, and Forces Manor used, or as was Ossian, they used to do host the Gurkha welfare appeal each year. So again, you've got this nice link. She would, I think, be really honoured to have a boat in her name that's linked to the military.
If you'd like to find out more, you can look at Tony's GoFundMe page. Just search for Veterans for Fishing at Forces Manor.
Yeah, I think they've got about maybe nearly £1,000 now, and they're certainly looking to raise at least £5,000 to make it happen.
Yeah, no, it sounds like an excellent idea.
Yeah, lots of lovely comments coming in today. This one from No Name, it says here, "Good morning, Mark and Rachel. Thank you for another brilliant, informative and seamless programme. We are just wondering what that person's listening to."
Seamless.
"We visited Military Museum of Scotland at Lindburn in West Lothian yesterday. Very well worth a visit. Small but packed with amazing collections of militaria, and the staff are just great."
Michael in Bournemouth says, "Hello, listening to you whilst making the journey by rail to beautiful Glasgow to the 57th Model Rail Scotland at the SEC. Fabulous event over 3 days with over 50 layouts and 145 exhibitor stands. It's on today and tomorrow if you fancy the trip south. Great show."
Brian in Inverurie says, "My maternal grandfather was one of the stonemasons who went to Australia to cut the granite for the Sydney Harbour Bridge." Fantastic.
And our audio supremo, Ron, has actually printed off this advert. I don't know when this is. It's obviously about 1900, roughly. And there is a diagram of the stone polishing machine saying, "Jenny Lind was no greater favourite as a singer than our Jenny Lind as a polisher."
Yeah, and you said, "Is that what it looked like?" And I can't.
You have no clue. Absolutely no. Might have been.
Maybe.
Yeah, might, possibly. This week, we got sad news. We learned of the sudden death of our former colleague at BBC Radio Orkney, Dave Gray. Now, Dave was a lovely guy. He was a champion of community broadcasting and spent many years working on and indeed running the station. We've been lucky enough to have many dealings with Dave over the years, not only during our trips to Orkney, but Dave actually presented this programme a few times back in the 90s. We wanted to put together this tribute to him and his wonderful and unique voice, starting with a reading we asked him to do for a special programme we did on George Mackay Brown, describing here the final hours of Magnus, later to become St. Magnus. "What's this? I'm bidden to a great feast, but here I stand, lost, on a dark moor, and I can hardly move for the heavy coat of state on my shoulders." I was a mechanic. I worked at the garage across the road for Radio Orkney, and I had a chance meeting with John Ferguson at the airport one day. I was there collecting somebody, and I sat down, the plane was delayed, and I just started speaking to John Ferguson. I didn't really know him that well, but, you know, knew of him. We're having a discussion, and he came up with a very dangerous question: "Do you listen to Radio Orkney?" Which, whatever answer you gave, it's not really the right one. So I said, "Well, I don't really listen to Radio Orkney that much, because they don't have anything on that I particularly am interested in. What are you interested in?" He says. I says, "I like heavy metal music and cars." So he said, "Right, okay, well, why don't you come across and do a heavy metal programme?" And there was a bit of a laugh and a bit of banter. We had a cup of coffee, and I, to be honest with you, I thought nothing more of it. I went back to work. A couple of days later, Ferg phoned up, and he says, "Say, when are you coming across to do that heavy metal programme?" And I thought, my goodness, he's actually serious. So I went across the road. I got shown the equipment, and I was basically left for the next 4 or 5 weeks. I came in at night, practiced, went home, came back in the next night and practiced. And after about 6 weeks, I'd gotten to the stage where I felt reasonably at home with the equipment. I felt as if I could put records on. I felt as if I could speak into a microphone, that type of thing. And he said, "Okay, that's it." And he just announced that there was a brand new Radio Orkney heavy metal programme starting. The audience was asked if they wanted to name it. Somebody suggested the name Metallic Grey. I didn't particularly like it at the time, but unfortunately I was overruled, and it became Metallic Grey, and I did Metallic Grey every Friday night for the next 6-7 years or so, and that was who I cut my teeth with live broadcasting. Tell us about The Bruck Show.
Credit where credit's due. I didn't think up The Bruck Show. The Bruck programme was suggested by a guy called Clive Brooks. Now, Clive lives on one of the islands. He lives on Edie.
And Clive suggested this format. Why don't you do a programme where people come on and exchange things, like somebody's got too many tatties and they want to exchange it for, I don't know, some asbestos sheeting or something like that. Why don't you do that type of programme? And we thought about it for a while and we thought, nah, that's never going to work, is it? Well, anyway, we'll give it a go. So we started chotting down a few ideas. What was it going to be called? Well, Brock is a kind of Orkney word for not rubbish, but maybe undiscovered stuff that you maybe hide at the back of the garage and might come in useful at some point. So it's Brock. So it's not really valuable, but could come in handy at some point. So we thought, let's call it Brock. We went on here, we came on and we explained the format, and people went absolutely crazy. I mean, I would never, ever have predicted that it would be such a success. So we had people phoning in saying, listen, I've got a starting handle for a Model T Ford and I'm really looking for a water boiler to make tea in the hall or something like that. This went on for years and years and years. We did this. I mean, one of the things that we did was scour the world for any connections with Orkney. Anybody, we interviewed the mayor of Orkney in South Africa. We interviewed the fire chief at Orkney Springs in Virginia. We interviewed anybody that had any vague connection with Orkney. One day, the guy who owns the local record shop came past and he said, listen, I don't know if this is something, but he says, I've just gotten this CD single. It's the debut single for this guy, David Gray. Of course, that's my name. So I looked and I heard David Gray, and it was his first single. I thought, wouldn't it be funny if we got ahead of David Gray and interviewed him and made a bit of a, had a bit of a laugh and all the rest of it. So we went to David Gray's management, got his contact details. He was willing to do it. We interviewed him on the Brock programme. And at the end of it, we're having a bit of a laugh. And I said, so David, I suppose your ambition in life is one day to become as famous as I am here in Orkney. And he said, oh yeah, that would be fantastic if I ever got to be that famous. Men pass me on the moor. They wear masks of wolf and raven. They seem to pass me, then come about. They stand in a yelping circle. They're the ones appointed, I think, to bring the Earl to the feast. A lot of Orkney accent and Orkney pronunciation of things is, I mean, to us, it's absolutely straightforward. To everybody else listening, it maybe sounds slightly strange. Now, I'll give you an example. Now, for the receptacle that you put your rubbish in, the black plastic receptacle, you would call it a rubbish bag or a rubbish sack or something like that. Now, the Orkney pronunciation of the word sack, S-A-C-K, is sack. And if you are speaking about more than one sec, you would say sex. So the problem with this is that...
I can see you
know where this is going. The council, of course, deliver rubbish bags, I'll say, at this particular time. So you got your delivery of rubbish bags. And one particular household had not received their delivery of rubbish bags. And the guy thought, well, I'll go in and I'll get them for the council. And he went up to the reception at the council, and a new lady from south of the border was working on the reception. And the guy says, I'm looking for rubbish sex. And the lady pushed a panic button and security arrived. A man stands before you, Magnus. He's poor, he's in tears. The X shakes in his hands. The spring morning is very cold. Put your coat of state about him, Magnus. Quick, let the silver cord be loosed. The dark waters rise up in me soul. Here's your ship of death, Magnus. Those bright ones, they ferry you over to the feast.
The voice there of Dave Gray. Safe to say, Dave will be sorely missed not only by the team in BBC Radio Orkney, but also practically everybody in the islands, the wider community there. He was a one-off. Not just a fantastic voice, but just fascinated by people.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant storyteller, clearly. And Radio Orkney did a special programme yesterday morning, a tribute to him, well worth a listen. You will find that on BBC Sounds.
I'll make a point of it.
Time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen.
Hello?
turns out it's not that much of a mystery anymore.
No.
We actually played out what it was, just people were paying attention.
Yep. Colin from Newton Mearns. Hi team, loving the show once again. Great way to start a Saturday. Heading up to Cairngorm's car park to tackle a few Munros today. Obviously today's sound is a tatty sorting machine. Have a great day.
Fiona and Boness got it correct too. Nameless got it correct. The features just literally covered it. They say, I guess the cat is out of the bag. Norman Ardisea, Gordon and Maureen Nettie-Bridge, Anne and Kirkwell Orkney.
Yep. Ian from Cairn Shore. It's a tatty sorter. Another cracking programme. Scott and Nadia from Bothwell as well. Also getting it right. We think the mystery sound is the tatty sorter working in the background of Mark's current interview about seed potatoes. It pays to wait and listen.
Yeah, and that's assuming we're correct. Gaynor Hall and Ballater got it right. Ron from A Cool Sterling and Siobhan Long in Spottiswood. Heaps and heaps of correct answers.
Yeah. Janet from Perth, Victoria in Edinburgh, Duncan in UC, you name it. All got it right.
Yeah, absolutely. So well done, all of those. That's it, sadly, from all of us. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. And in our midweek podcast, I visit my idea of having a sawmill to meet furniture makers who are creating new objects. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.